This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. Coming up, the work of the Port Morian Wildlife Association, a program to help women entrepreneurs on the island, reporting potholes, and some returning Cape Breton talent for CBU's men's soccer team. That's coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. For 90 years now, the Port Morian Wildlife Association has been doing its thing. But what exactly does a wildlife association do? Well, a lot more than you probably know. Dialogue spoke with the president of the Port Morian Wildlife Association, Jeff McNeil. Jeff, first of all, let's start out with just the fact that if I said to you, the Port Morian Wildlife Association, it's not really known exactly what the Wildlife Association does. And maybe, just maybe, it's not understood by the majority of people what you do and how much you do. In other words, you're a little bit misunderstood as to what your organization is about. Is that a fair statement?
That is truly a fair statement to say, Dave.
Tell us a little bit about what your organization is and what it does.
Well, our organization is made up of hunters, anglers, trappers, It's a wide demographic. We have a large age demographic as well, but we have people from a whole pile of different professions. We have people, though, although the organization was started out with hunters and anglers, it has since brought in people there that just want to bird watch and hike trails and just contribute to conservation projects. Like our organization does a lot of different conservation projects, the loon nesting islands for one example, the bat nesting boxes. We put out wood duck nesting boxes as well. Most of the wood duck nesting boxes we get community involvement, so we go to the schools and we'll get the industrial arts class to build them for us, and as they're building them, they're learning why we're asking them to build it as well. There's advocacy programs that we do. We go to government and we advocate for legislation changes. We've regulation changes to the current hunting and fishing regulations in the province. We've asked for changes there to benefit anglers of the province as well as hunters of the province. There's been some issues there that we've touched on that don't normally see eye to eye with some people, but when they sit down and have the conversation and learn why we are putting certain things forward for change, it opens up their eyes, and most times they're pretty receptive to stuff like that.
How big is your association, Jeff?
We are right now, Dave, at about 80 members and climbing.
So that's still a lot of work. That's a lot of stuff to cover for just 80 members, is it not?
It is, but like any organization, dedicated volunteers are hard to come by. It's easy to pick up some members there that'll join the organization just for the sake of saying, well, I'm a member of Port Morian Wildlife Association. They do great work. We don't mind that. We have members as well that sometimes Dave can't get out and participate because of illnesses and what have you. But the dedication of volunteers is the big thing, and we're always looking for new members to join our endeavors and help us roll out these projects.
Wait, one would think by the name Port Morian Wildlife Association that you'd just be interested in doing it within the confines of that community of Port Morian, but nothing could be further from the truth, right?
That's a fact. There are conservation projects. We've got conservation projects up in Middle River, Marguerite, Pleasant Bay, Shetty Camp, St. Peter's, Port Hawkesbury, as far away as Manadooch and the Waterfort and everywhere in between. So we're not just localized there for conservation projects, nor are we localized in just the Port Morian area for our Learn to Fish programs that we do. Currently, we've done some out at, they call it Round Lake, just outside of Bredora there. We've done Learn to Fish programs in City Mines, North Sydney for the 4-H group there. Geez, Dave, we've been all over with them projects, and we've even our aquarium projects in the schools, where we have four schools with aquarium projects. That in itself is a task. The kids get to raise eggs or trout from eggs. As soon as the trout hatch, they're there for another 4 to 6 weeks in the classroom. The kids learn the life cycle of the speckled trout. And then we end up doing a field trip day with them to do a release in local waterways. Something similar to what we do on a larger scale at our Sand Lake facility, where we raise them, hatch them to their fry, and then put them in local waterways for conservation efforts.
You're getting close to 100 years old, the organization. You're 92 now. It doesn't sound like you're slowing down.
You know what? In the last little bit, it picked up. A lot of our members, Dave, I wish I could say we had a lot of younger members, but this day and age, I guess, no interest maybe, or they just aren't aware, but our aging members are dedicated, I can tell you that. Some days I have a hard enough job trying to keep up with them, with what they want to do.
But of course, you're always open to new members and younger members.
No younger. If you have mobility issues as well, hey, we're open to anything. We're open to any new ideas. Show up to a meeting. You don't have to join our meetings. You can show up, take part in a meeting, see what it's about, learn what we're doing. If you want to join, that's fine. If not, that's fine as well. We're receptive to either or.
Speaking of mobility issues, your latest endeavor is a barrier-free wheelchair accessible fishing site facility at the John Berner Croke Memorial Park in Glace Bay. Jeff, tell us about that.
That is one of the largest undertakings that our organization in the 92 years it has been in existence has ever taken, Dave. That right off the bat, we set a deadline to try to pull this off by March 31st of this year. The project itself has to do with allowing people in wheelchairs. It doesn't matter if you're in a wheelchair or a walker, any mobility issues, it gives them a safe location that is currently up to the standards set out by the province under Bill 59, which is an accessibility act that's supposed to be met by 2030. So it would give us a centralized location to hold a lot of our projects, because Dave, as you know, we've got children in schools that have mobility issues. They could be confined to a wheelchair. For us to find a location to have them included in a lot of our projects is difficult. I'll use the Sydney Mines example there at the pediatrics. We had a couple children in wheelchairs that were there and different mobility issues. The volunteer fire department there, and that helped put down plywood and that so we can make something work. So when we've done Learn to Fish programs with the schools and that, we've come to them hurdles that we have to face to try to make something work, Dave, because we want everybody included and be part of it. And the thing with that was it really opened our eyes, because we said, hey, there's a need for this. If we can get this in the Glace Bay area, let's do it. Originally, we tried to look at a different area out around where our organization has the two buildings and facilities, but geographically, we couldn't pull it off. We got permission from CBRM to utilize the land there, and we got all the T's crossed, I's dotted on that note. Our biggest problem now with trying to roll this out is we're trying to seek the funding because we want it all-inclusive for anybody with a mobility issue. So that could be a child, that could be a senior, that could be a veteran, a first responder. It gives them a spot. We have an agreement set in place with Nova Scotia Inland Fisheries to provide us with the fish. They do normally each year anyway. But this year we've got some extra fish coming there because of the projects we're planning on rolling out as well. And it's just our biggest feat now, Dave, is we've applied for funding at the government levels, but we've hit some stone walls there because originally we budgeted for the project to be about $30,000, and when we got the quotes, we're looking between $65,000-$70,000. Currently, right now, we've had one organization contribute to our fundraising efforts, and that was Dylan Yates' group, the Cape Breton Environmental Association. They had made a donation to us towards the project, so it's nowhere near what we need. I'll be honest, Dave, we got $150 towards the project so far, and in the last few months, we've been pounding on doors, and we've been going outside of our own comfort level because normally we don't pound on business doors asking for a handout. But we see how worthy this cause is to have in the Glace Bay area. And it will be a focal point moving forward. And it kind of plays hand in hand with our next project that we have that we're rolling out, where not only are we going to take children out on Learn to Fish programs and that, but we've working on another project there now where we have our members going to have seniors in long-term care facilities. Doesn't matter their mobility issues. They can come out, take part. If they haven't taken part before, that's fine. We want them to come out and try it. We've talked to Parkland, the recreation coordinator there. They're on side. I've reached out to member two, and their elders they're on side with sending some of their elders to this year in May and June as well. And we're trying to include everybody because I'll be honest, Dave, my mom had taken a stroke this year, and I've seen the challenges that seniors face just from being in the hospital aspect. And there's some people, Dave, that I refer to as the forgotten ones, that they deserve a chance to go out and enjoy something new, right? Outside of a hospital or a long-term care. So when we pitched the idea to our members were in full support of it. So now we're trying to get the community more involved with trying to fund this program.
It's pretty positive and a worthwhile endeavor. And, of course, all of the stuff that you're talking about, including that latest project, it's all done by volunteers, right?
Everything is done by volunteers. Not one of our members is a paid member for any of this.
So you're open to businesses and individual donors. How do they go about doing that, Jeff?
Well, if they want, Dave, we've got an email there. It is pmwa1928@gmail.com. You can email us on that. Any members or businesses or community members that have access to a computer want, they can also e-transfer. And if they put in the message there, donation for the John Berner Croak Accessibility Project, well, then we know that goes towards that project and it helps us. We also have a GoFundMe website set up. It's www.gofundme.com/F/1UB2G84NDC.
And anybody who's willing to help in any way, shape, or form, you'd welcome their participation. Listen, Jeff, thanks very much for filling us in on exactly what the Port Morium Wildlife Association is involved in. good luck in all your endeavors and keep up the fine work.
We appreciate it, Dave, and thanks for taking the time to allow us to at least give the community a little bit of what we do and understanding, because a lot of people, they don't quite understand what we do.
The provincial NDP transportation critic wants you to report potholes that you've come across. Dartmouth North MLA Susan LeBlanc says the province's compensation program for damages caused by potholes isn't doing much to help frustrated drivers. There were 900 claims last year. Only 5% were approved. LeBlanc says that points to a bigger problem. The province says it's not liable if they don't know about the pothole. She spoke with Dialogue's Bill McCush.
Your riding probably has a lot in common with us here on the island when it comes to potholes, especially this time of year. What kind of concerns are you hearing from your constituents about road conditions?
Well, we're just at the beginning of the season when we're talking about potholes. For sure, last year we were really, really busy. We had a lot of people calling in potholes. As you know, a number of folks in my constituency who had, you know, complained to the province, put in claims for damage to their vehicles, and then, found out later that they wouldn't be getting those damages back.
Can you talk about the provincial program that's available for Nova Scotians who have their vehicles damaged from striking a pothole?
So it's a program that's administered through the Department of Service Nova Scotia in conjunction with Transportation and Infrastructure Renewal. And, basically if one sustains damage to their cars, they can apply for, send the receipts in or whatever, and then they're told whether or not the province will pay for those damages. Now, internally, the department has a number of metrics that they use to determine whether or not the province is liable for the damages. And it can be, it has to do with the type of road or highway, the depth of the pothole, the radius of the pothole, all kinds of different things go into it. And so depending on the size and the number, the type of highway or road, the department has different amounts of time in which they have to fix the pothole. So if they don't fix the pothole within their own prescribed amount of time, then they would pay damages to someone who damaged their car on a pothole. The issue with that is that there's also kind of a moving target when it comes to that. We've learned from people who work in the department that there's also extenuating circumstances. So, for instance, if there's bad weather or if there's a lack of available road crews, and so all of these things combined with the already confusing sort of measure of when a pothole needs to be fixed, it basically makes it really, really hard to figure out if, in fact, someone or the province is liable for damages. It's a moving target. There's no transparency. It also has to do with when someone first reports a pothole. It's very confusing.
A damaged vehicle caused by a pothole means an unexpected expense for many people who couldn't afford it or barely afford it. And are you hearing concerns about the time it takes for the government to respond or to decide if they will offer compensation for a damaged vehicle?
Well, that's it. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that people are told to get the repairs done and then, they would be compensated in retroactively for the cost. For sure, with some of my constituents, they were months and months and months waiting. In those cases, they were denied. Then they went through an appeals process where there was an external evaluator. But for months, they didn't hear anything. That's why I was even involved. I was checking in for them on their cases. And ultimately, after all of that waiting, we're told that they would not be getting damages back. It's an extremely frustrating and lengthy process.
Do you have advice for drivers who can help them better connect with the government to qualify for this program in meeting that criteria?
It is important that everyone who sees potholes or encounters potholes should report them, and they can do that by calling their local. I don't have the number in front of me right now, but there's an 800 number for transportation and infrastructure renewal, and it may be different for different parts of the province, like the local numbers. But what happens is when you call in a pothole, you get a like a ticket order, basically, or a ticket number. And so that's important that everyone continues to do that, because that's the only way that we can begin to track, you know, when potholes are first reported. But in terms of advice, I mean, I guess, unfortunately, based on the numbers that we've seen, you know, it's not a hopeful process, but, you know, some claims are paid out. So, you know, right now, the last year, I believe, there was about 5% of claims that were paid out. But, you know, those that 5%, you know, those folks were happy, presumably. I guess I would say that the public, if this is an unsatisfactory number to them, which it is to me, I think that, you know, letters to the minister are in order. I think that, you know, putting pressure on the government to make these programs transparent and to make sure that they are clearly communicating the processes to people who do apply for damages is really, really important. Because I think that part of it is, I mean, we can't expect potholes to get fixed instantaneously. That is not going to, that's not possible. But we can expect a reasonable amount of time, and we can expect the government to be upfront about what the situation is.
Sure. Over the past few years, roughly between 600, 1,000 people in somewhere in that ballpark have applied for compensation for damages. And as you said, 5, 6, 7, 8% success rate, very low. What percentage rate would your party like to see?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think that's a hard question to answer. Obviously, you know, the fact is that we pay for these roads. These are publicly funded roads with public money. And so, the government, the public, the government must be liable for some, you know, some issues to make sure that the roads are properly maintained, for instance. If there's no impetus for the government to keep the roads in good condition, then, you know, who knows what could happen. So we need to see the roads being kept up better. There needs to be a good incentive for that. But also, you know, there needs to be people need to have a fair shot of getting damages. I mean, the problem is now is that we don't actually know if the government is even adhering to its own guidelines, because there's no transparency. There's no way to track that stuff. So it's, like I said, it's hard to put a number on you know, how many claims should be paid. But right now we don't even know, you know, why it's not happening properly or why the numbers are so low.
Do you know of any examples involving a municipality compensating for damages resulting from potholes? Because this program, of course, would just be for provincially designated highways and roads. Can you see municipalities getting involved with a program like this down the road?
Yeah. In fact, I'm not sure, actually, it may vary from municipality to municipality, but I'm not really sure what the situation is at that level. But yeah, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, if there are issues with our public infrastructure, then they need to be looked after by the level of government that looks after them. You know, the thing that I always come back to with these stories from my constituents, you know, in one case, the family, a wheel came off their car and their rim was cracked. They sustained, you know, over $1,000 of damage. But like, imagine if that had happened and there was a car right behind them. You know, like, I hate to think about these issues happening and then actually people being hurt and seriously injured because of the issues. So that's where I go with this, you know, and I hope that we can address some of this. I know in my own driving I drive the 111 highway, what we call the circumferential in Dartmouth, quite a lot. And at certain times in sort of like late winter, early spring, the roads are horrendous. Last year was particularly terrible. And it's really scary to think about driving on those roads when, you know, rush hour, when the roads are full, and, you know, what could happen if you hit the pothole the wrong way or whatever.
Think the province should be encouraged to put more of an effort into road maintenance, preventing the potholes from popping up in communities?
Well, yeah. I mean, every time I've asked the minister about this issue, or if my colleagues in the legislature have asked about it, you know, it's always about, the question is always like, what are you going to do about the potholes? Wouldn't it be great if potholes didn't happen? I mean, I know that there's only a certain amount of control we have because of our climate and our freezing, thawing cycles that happen here. I think in our area, we have worse situations than in other places. But surely there are ways of looking at preventative, exactly as you say, preventative measures so that we're not having this problem every single year. I don't know what they are. I'm not a highway engineer, but it would be great to look into that and find out if there are things we could be doing differently.
And what would an NDP government do to revamp this program for compensation for damages?
Well, I mean, I think that we would make the program more transparent so that folks, number one, know what they're getting into when they make these claims, and make sure that the timelines are sufficient. So, you know, at the very least, measures could be put in place to mark potholes and mark situations where roads are damaged immediately or, you know, within a couple of hours. That can't be, again, I'm not a road engineer. I'm not a worker in that department. But the idea of knowing that there's a dangerous pothole and being able to put, you know, a pylon or a sign in front of it seems like something that should be done kind of immediately. So that's number one, because that's about safety. But, you know, our call of the government is to make this program transparent and to make sure that those metrics are actually fair for Nova Scotians.
If I can just for a moment refer to the press release your party issued recently about the program. Karen Cole had to replace all four tires of her car after hitting a pothole last spring. That must have been a monster of a pothole to damage all four tires.
Yes, I don't know about her case in particular, but yes, but I'm telling you, the potholes in Dartmouth are gigantic. I have hit some myself. I've luckily not sustained damage or injury, but they're, you know, on the CIRC, which is the highway I drive a lot, it can be a real mess. And I hear from people on a regular basis through the late winter about it. But again, you know, four tires having to be replaced. That's a big bang to a car. Again, in the case of one of my constituents, a tire was replaced and a rim was cracked. That's also a big bang. So these are not tiny little holes that you sort of, you know, give your car a little bump and you keep going. These are, you know, car stopping situations.
If you want to report a pothole you've come across, call 1-888-432-3233. It's called the Microloan Program for Women and came about after some recent studies that focused on women entrepreneurs in Cape Breton and the challenges they face in operating or starting a business. The Sydney Credit Union and Cape Breton Partnership are collaborating on the project. Dialogue spoke with Sydney Credit Union CEO Carol Ripley and the partnership's Inclusive Innovation Officer, Jenna Leahy.
At the Cape Breton Partnership, we've undertaken two research studies in the last year that looks specifically at female entrepreneurs on the island. So we've looked at the general population of women, but we've also looked specifically at Mi'kmaq women in entrepreneurship. And so a lot of the work that we're doing now, pushing these microloan program forward, came from that barrier. So most of the women on the island identified financing as one of the major gaps, major barriers to entrepreneurship for them.
What else did you find?
We found that they need business support. So a lot of research shows that just offering microloan programs, as they do across the country, while that is very helpful, it's not the whole puzzle. So you need guidance when you're starting business. So some mentorship, some, you know, just accessing services. Where can you go for certain training? Mm-hmm. And so the Cape Breton Partnership is offering that, while the credit union is offering the finance part. We're offering the mentorship and the guidance piece.
Carol, why did Sydney Credit Union decide to become involved?
So the mission and vision of Sydney Credit Union has always been to support the financial well-being of our members, but also the economic and well-being of our whole community. So supporting our business and the entrepreneurs in our area is extremely important for the health of Sydney, you know, Sydney and the CBRM. So that was very important to us. And when we saw that there was this gap in financing for women, female entrepreneurs, we thought it was a perfect fit for Sydney Credit Union.
What's the level of funding that they women will be eligible for, and how do they go about getting it?
So it is a pilot program. So per individual, the maximum loan would be $10,000. And they can start by going to the Cape Breton Partnership. There's a site there on the Cape Breton Partnership website, and there's a microloan link there, and they can go in and they can actually enter their information, what kind of business they're in, and how much financing they need. And we will partner with the Cape Breton Partnership. If they come into the credit union first, that's fine, and we will connect them with the partnership as well. But we will talk to them about an application for financing right at the credit union as well.
What exactly can that amount of money do for someone who's looking to start up a new business? Are they going to be saying, well, take this $10,000 and just start? Can you get a fresh start with that amount of money?
For a lot of the women that we spoke to, small injections of cash, you know, it could be as little as $500, can make a huge difference in just building your inventory or, you know, doing an update to your website. So even low levels of funding can just have huge impacts for women-led businesses on the island.
Are a lot of people, like, afraid to come into a credit union or whatever and say, look, I need this much money to help me start a business? They're just kind of nervous to even take that first step?
Absolutely. So there are women out there who have a great idea, but they don't think that they have a financially viable idea. So they're not comfortable or they're not confident enough to go into a financial institution. So with this program, we're hoping we can help, especially with the mentorship that the partnership will be offering. We can mentor them and they will definitely feel comfortable and they'll be able to do those applications for funding that they may not have been comfortable doing before.
More and more women these days becoming involved in entrepreneurship?
Absolutely. When I first started this position, I had this naive idea that I was going to be able to track all of the female entrepreneurs on the island. That idea died pretty fast. There's just so many women here running businesses, whether they're, you know, small businesses or micro businesses where, you know, it might just be them working out of their house. But there's such an entrepreneurial spirit here in Cape Breton, and it's growing daily.
But we see it grow all the time, right? We see small business people who start out, and then all of a sudden they're operating a storefront business, and then the next thing you know, with online and all that, mm-hmm. that's available through social media these days. It doesn't take much to get a good start.
No, it's really quite amazing the reach that, you know, a small business here in Cape Breton Unimagi can have, you know, reaching markets all across the world.
So. Yeah, and it all adds up. Small businesses are part of the economy right now, right?
Absolutely. SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises, are the backbone of our economy. So it's extremely important that we support that economic activity because it supports the whole community.
So it sounds like a great idea. It sounds like the two groups have come together and said, we can take something that should be simple and make it really, really simple by adding the support that should be there. Is it that easy, though? Can somebody just walk into say, I have an idea, and walk into you and say, look, I want to put this idea, hopefully it'll work. You'll take it from there.
Well, I mean, it has to be, a good idea. It can't just be any old idea. We have to be able to see that, you know, it's being thought through, that there is a plan in place, you know. It doesn't have to be a full-blown business plan, but they have to have the idea. They have to have the forethought of how they're going to execute these things.
That's what you're there to help with.
Exactly. And you know, we are going to do our due diligence, of course, look at market research to make sure that the businesses are, you know, viable, that they are something that could work here on the island. But it's a much simpler process than they have been in the past. You know, it's a really simple application. And the application itself gets you to start thinking about how you can execute your business. So
how long there are deadlines that you'll have? How long does the program run?
So the program is a pilot. So we have a maximum amount of $100,000 that we're starting with in the pilot. But depending on the success of the pilot, it could be something we roll out permanently afterwards. So there's no time deadlines. So we're just going to keep lending money. Hopefully we'll have lots of female entrepreneurs looking for it. And when we reach the pilot maximum, then we'll have more discussions to see if we want to continue the program. Not in a pilot, but as a permanent structure.
That's a good start, $100,000.
Yeah.
That's a really good start.
Exactly. And like Jenna said, it's not always $10,000 loans, so that's only 10 people, but there's a lot of them would be a lot smaller. So we could reach a large number of female entrepreneurs with this program.
Great idea. Thanks for coming in and sharing it with us this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Carol, Jenna, good luck with the program. Anybody who's interested, they can
drop in to see Sydney Credit Union at any of the branches, or they can talk to the Cape Breton Partnership as well, or go to the website.
Go to the website and reach you online.
Absolutely.
the seven-time AUS champion CBU men's soccer team is getting some more homegrown talent for the upcoming season. Myra native Noah Leahy is coming back home from Halifax, where he's currently playing for the CPA Cheetahs. Leahy is one of the few local student athletes to join last year's national bronze medal men's soccer program at CBU, and the winger says he's excited about getting to work on the field and in the classroom.
Can you talk about the conversation with Coach Morley and his staff that led you to coming back to the island to play for the Capers?
He just kind of told me what their program was all about, like the hard work ethic, like the focus on education as well, and that really enticed me to go there. So, I just want to be a part of the team because, like, the work ethic is really good. The overall feel of the team and, like, the chemistry they have together is, like, it's, like, I haven't experienced that before with any other teams. So, you know, I just really like the atmosphere of the school and the team, and I think they got something special going on there with a really good set of coaches and a really good atmosphere in the school and on the team. So, yeah, I'm excited to come back.
Who are you playing for now?
Currently I'm playing for Suburban SC in Halifax.
And what kind of league is that?
That's the Premier Men's Division for Nova Scotia. So it's basically just the highest league in Nova Scotia you could play.
So your skills are already have been developed from playing with this league, so you would fit into a nationally recognized program like the CBU men's soccer team.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I've been practicing like every day, spent lots of time in the gym and stuff like that to get ready to fit into CBU, so hopefully that all pays off.
When did you start playing soccer?
I started when I was 4 years old playing for Albert Bridge Soccer. And then I eventually, when I was 8 years old, I started playing for the Cape Breton Regional Training Center program. And after that, I went on to play with the provincial program. Played a year with the Whitecaps Academy in Halifax. And then I just continued playing with the Nova Scotia provincial team and Suburban FC after that. So I moved from Cape Breton to Halifax when I was 15 years old, to play with the Vancouver Whitecaps Academy there, and ever since I've been up here playing in the for the provincial team and in the men's premier division, so I've been busy with that.
The young soccer players here on Cape Breton, they come from very impressive programs. The skill level here is quite high and across Nova Scotia. Is that something you would agree to, Noah?
I think there's a lot of great role models to look up to in Cape Breton and stuff. And having the CBU players actually coaching some of the programs is good for the young players to inspire to, and hopefully they can eventually be successful someday like their coaches are. So they have a lot of good role models to look up to, and I think that's really important.
Who are some of those role models and the mentors that you had here in Cape Breton before you moved to Halifax?
I was coached by Mike Wyatt when he was in Cape Breton. He was probably my greatest mentor while I was there. Also, Jeff Baker, Richard Risk was another one. He played for the CBU Capers. So just people like that made a huge difference in my career. And without them, I probably wouldn't be where I am today.
So you grew up in the Myra area, is that correct?
Yeah.
And you still have family there?
Yeah, my parents and brother still live there, yeah.
And what do your friends and family think about you moving back to Cape Breton to play soccer at CBU?
They're happy. They're a little bit surprised. But, I just love the atmosphere of the team and love the atmosphere of the school. So, you know, like, they were happy with my decision, but at the end of the day, it was my decision that I made, and I think I made a good one. So,
you're one of a few players on the roster for the upcoming season that are from Cape Breton originally. Do you think that will encourage more fans to come out and watch the games?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I mean, there isn't a whole lot of local players just like on any other team. So, I mean, having local players on any team will encourage local fans to start showing up to more games and things like that. supporting the team more. Like, the team already has a massive amount of support, but I think that having local players on any team will for sure increase the following of the team.
What can you say about Coach Morley and his staff at the helm of a very successful program regionally and nationally?
Yeah, for sure. Well, the assistant coach, Scott Clark, when I was in Cape Breton, he had played a big part in coaching youth in Cape Breton, so I had him as a coach a couple times. So I already have a little bit of a relationship with him, and I think he's a great coach, and he's a great person. I'm looking forward to working with him. And for Coach Dino Morley, I thought everybody knows about him in Nova Scotia, obviously, just because he's such a big character in the soccer community here, and I've heard nothing but good things about him, so I'm looking forward to working with him as well.
What will you be studying at CBU?
Business.
Okay, what led you to being interested in studying business?
Throughout high school, I've always been more successful with business courses over any other. And also, I come from a business family, so I have lots of support there. So, maybe try to stay in Cape Breton, but if I need to go abroad, then so be it.
What does a varsity student do in the off season to stay sharp with their skills? Soccer is a very demanding game physically. So, how do you stay in shape during the off season?
I spend a lot of hours in the gym. I go every day, and I think that plays a key factor since I'm a very physical player, and that's a huge element of my game. And also, just practicing at home, getting lots of touches in on the ball and stuff like that, really helps to stay sharp in the off season. And going to the gym, like I said, is also very important.
Are there any other sports that you're interested in?
I was never really a huge multi-sport athlete. I always played, I played football and basketball and stuff like that, kind of just for fun. But soccer was always my main sport.
Do you think parents are encouraging their kids more to play soccer when you consider how expensive it is now for young people to play hockey?
Yeah, for sure. All you really need to play soccer is a pair of cleats and maybe a ball. So, that's a very attractive thing for parents with young kids if, they don't want to pay a lot of money to put their kids in organized sports. Once you kind of develop yourself and go on to higher levels of soccer, it obviously gets more expensive with, going on trips and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, soccer is one of the more cheaper sports you can play, so I think that's attractive for a lot of parents trying to put their kids in organized sports. I think that's a good thing.
For anyone who hasn't played soccer, can you explain the athleticism that's involved and the physical demand?
Yeah, it's definitely not easy. I couldn't tell you the amount of hours I spent at the gym working on the physical side of my game, because that's a very important part. As far as the physical aspect goes, it's not like any other sport I played. You've got to be extremely fit and work really hard to keep in top shape to play soccer at a high level.
Why do you think soccer is such a popular sport all over the world?
Well, I think in developing countries it's big because it's really cheap, and a lot of players in developing countries are extremely invested in trying to play professional soccer because that may be the only avenue for them to make a living for themselves. So I think that's a big aspect. And also, it's a beautiful game, so I think people just really enjoy watching it. And yeah.
What's your favorite team?
Since I was about, let's say, 10 years old, my mom went on a trip to England, and she brought me home a Liverpool jersey, and ever since, I just kind of liked Liverpool, so yeah.
Do you still have the jersey?
I do, yeah.
Are other members of your family soccer fans?
My parents are soccer fans and stuff. My mom's sister played soccer for the University of Toronto. So, there has been some soccer players in my family, but I wouldn't say it's just mainly soccer. I have relatives that play other sports as well, so.
A lot of student athletes will tell you that when the season's over, the work doesn't end. Is that true, Noah?
No, it's not. You gotta stay in the gym. You gotta keep practicing, keep your ball work up and just your technical and tactical abilities. Make sure you're always studying the game, just watching games and stuff like that and just practicing. So you got to make sure you're in tip-top condition for when the season starts back up again, and that that comes from months and months of working really hard. So,
What about the schedule balancing sport and academics for a student athlete? How demanding is that?
It is pretty demanding. I mean, I've had a lot of practice at it, so I'm getting pretty good at it. So I should be pretty good by the time university comes, but you're really going to do work hard. You know, just getting everything done as soon as you get it and stuff. And prioritizing schoolwork over soccer. Because the harsh reality is for a lot of these players, you know, soccer isn't going to pay the bills. And it'll give you the utilities to go where you want to go and the skill set. But, I mean, for a lot of players, the reality is it's not going to pay the bills. So I would advise to put academics first. And Dino Morley actually told me, he said, if you don't keep your marks up, you're not allowed, I won't be able to play on the team. Like, you don't really want a team full of players that are going to drop at a university and stuff like that. And also, in reality, is like people who study a lot and are articulate are usually better players because they understand the game more and they're able to read, you know, like read the game and study and stuff like that. So I think like smarter people, and not so much smarter, but harder working people when it comes to school often make better soccer players.
Do you think about the possibilities of playing professionally after you graduate from CBU?
Yeah, I mean, it would be amazing. It is something that I would definitely not be opposed to. I'm going to work really hard to try to achieve that goal. But, I mean, if it doesn't happen, I'm going to a great school, so I'll have a great education as a backup plan.
What kind of advice, when it comes to work ethic, would you pass on to a young person who would perhaps like to follow in your footsteps?
I would just say to stay motivated, stay working on your physical shape. That's very important. You know, like go get in the gym and stuff like that. Also, don't focus all on that. I mean, work on your tactical and technical abilities as well. Make sure that's in tip-top condition.
And that's our show for today. As always, thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.